My name is Keaton Mowry. As we said, this was a large project, took a while, and absolutely would not have been possible without my colleagues at UC San Diego, University of Michigan, and Johns Hopkins University. We're going to be talking today about the security analysis of a full-body scanner. And I'd like to start with a note of warning. Full-body scanners, by design, look under clothing for possible contraband that's hidden. So by design and to fulfill their purpose, they produce naked images of the scanned subject. We will be showing unmodified images from the scanner during this talk and in the paper. So to go ahead and start, if you've flown anywhere in the United States in the last 5 years, you've interacted with full-body scanners, either by going through them and being scanned or by opting out. Either way, they've impacted your day. There are two main types of full-body scanners that were placed into United States airports. First is the Rapiscan Secure 1000 backscatter X-ray devices that you see on the left. And there's also the L3 ProVision millimeter wave scanners that you see on the right. So if we actually look at a timeline of when these devices were implemented, we see in February 2007, the TSA introduces both of these devices to airports as secondary screening. So if a metal detector goes off, you have a choice to go through one of these. In December of 2009, there was a failed bombing on a transatlantic flight. Less than a week later, TSA decided to move full-body scanners to primary screening so that all passengers would be directed through them. In late 2012, while the machines were still in use in airports, we purchased a Secure 1000 X-ray backscatter machine, and it arrived at our lab. This is the machine we have. This is the machine we can talk about. And so all of our results will be based on this machine. It turns out that due to changing requirements about privacy, the TSA decided to retire the Rapiscan Secure 1000 from airports in May 2013. The L3 machines are still in use. When these machines were placed into airports and made primary, there was a huge public debate. First, the Rapiscan Secure 1000 uses ionizing radiation to produce a naked image of people. That's what it does. That's what it's built to do. And so the first question is it safe? You really want to minimize your dose of radiation that you get, and there's a lot of questions. There were a lot of questions over what the dose was and whether it was safe to walk through them. The second is privacy. These produce naked images of people. There were allegations that TSA agents were taking possibly an undue interest in scanning attractive women. And then the third thing is, okay, we're giving up a little bit of safety, we're getting radiation, we're giving up privacy. Do they work? Do they actually detect contraband? Do they improve airport security? TSA, by and large, chose not to make public their assessment of the devices. The documents that were extracted via lawsuit and FOIA request came out heavily redacted like this. And this lack of fact really kind of stirred the debate. So as security researchers, when faced with a lack of fact, what do? Go to eBay. We purchased one of these devices on eBay, as I said, in November 2012, got it in our lab. And once we got it there, we looked at this public debate and decided and came up with three main pillars that we wanted to look at. First, is the Secure 1000 radiologically safe? Can you go through it without too much risk? What privacy safeguards exist in the device? And how effective is it at detecting contraband? However, we feel that there was an aspect missing from the public debate, which is that this is a complex cyberphysical system. It involves computers, it involves software, and that impacts each of these questions. And the impact of software on those questions had not been brought up by anyone. So when we when the machine was shipped to us in these lovely shipping crates, we decided to take it apart, learn some things about it, but we realized that we had to go back and learn some X-ray physics. The device uses relatively low energy X-rays, approximately 50 kiloelectron volts at 5 milliamps. Most of the time, we're used to X-rays being a through-body image, like you might get at the dentist or on your leg. These use higher energy X-rays that actually penetrate through the human body. The two important physical effects that we had to learn about was the photoelectric effect and the Compton scattering. In the photoelectric effect, a photon impacts an electron, the electron is ejected at some speed, and the photon is absorbed completely. Under Compton scattering, the photon hits an electron, the electron is ejected, but there's also a lower energy scattered photon that comes out in an unpredictable direction. This is actually what causes the backscatter that the machine uses. And it turns out, if you go into the materials science, the dominant effect as to which one happens more depends on the material's effective atomic number, basically what elements it's made up out of. Organic materials with a lot of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, the Compton scattering effect dominates, and so they backscatter a lot. Heavier things made out of iron and heavier metals, the photoelectric effect dominates, and so they backscatter not very much at all. So given these physical processes, how do you actually turn that into an image? Well, in the Secure 1000, it uses a reverse raster camera design. A central X-ray tube A generates the X-rays, which then pass through a spinning chopper wheel B, which generates a really thin collimated beam that sweeps across the scene. This beam goes out into the scene, interacts with the subject C. Depending on the material at that location, some backscatter is generated and is detected by 8 large photomultiplier tubes, D. Okay, so that's sort of the overall diagram of how it works. What does this look like in practice? Well, if you look very closely, you can see the chopper wheel here. And if you look even closer, you can watch it start to spin up. It's a fairly heavy wheel because it has to block radiation. It takes a while to spin up. And then when the scan starts, the entire head assembly will move vertically, sweeping the scan line across all of the subject. But that's fairly terrifying to look at, a few inches from your face. So what does this look like for someone being scanned? Here you can see an example. It looks much like a large gray box that you stand in front of. I would like to note at this point that we had the dual pose model, so the person must turn around between screenings. The TSA had a slightly different model, which appears to have just been two scanners facing each other, so you didn't have to move between scans. Okay, so this is what it looks like to the person being screened. Now let's look at what the operator sees. As I said, these images are fairly explicit, so be prepared. So here's what you see. The first thing you might notice is that this subject should probably undergo further screening. But there's some important things I want to point out about this image. First is that flesh, organic material, shows up white. It backscatters quite a bit. That turns into a white pixel in the display. Off to the sides of the person, where the X-ray beam travels off into space and does not actually interact with anything, there's no backscatter, and it's black. You will also notice that density plays a big role in the interaction of X-rays and matter. The X-rays go directly through the clothing, which you can barely see, and produce this naked image against the dense flesh. And then the metal handgun, when the beam sweeps across it, it absorbs most of the X-rays and therefore appears black. You can also notice some other interesting things in this image, including shin bones, the spine, some ribs, the pants, zipper, some other rivets, and our subject's dosimeter. So this is how the machine works and the images it produces. Let's look at what we found. So the first thing is radiation safety. Is it safe to stand next to this device? And we used this radiological phantom to run an experiment. Again, X-ray energy is about 50 kilovolts at 5 milliamps. And we found that using this phantom that simulates a human, the dose per scan is about 70 to 80 nanosieverts. That's an estimation of the health impact of a scan. This equates to about 24 minutes of background exposure, so approximately what you'd get sitting in this talk. While we were performing this experiment, the American Association of Physicists in Medicine actually worked with the TSA, did some very good measurements and came up with a result that came very close to ours. This is under normal scanning operation. So this is, you walk in, it works. But the question we have to ask as computer science security researchers is, can the machine malfunction? And what does it look like when it does? Well, as we were disassembling the machine and looking at how it worked, we found that there were, in fact, safety controls, interlocks, that examined the radiological output and the proper working of the device and would terminate X-ray production if things went out of bounds. These were not security controls. Software can bypass them. We looked at whether a remote attacker could actually compromise the machine and cause excess radiation to be emitted. We found that they used a very simple modular design, and we were unable to make that happen. But software, it doesn't only run on the embedded side of this device. It also runs on the operator console, which is, you can see a picture of what the operator looks at here. This runs on a in DOS under Windows 98. If an attacker is able to modify or compromise the software, either through physical access to the operator console or via the network, they can actually replace this software or modify it to do their bidding. We built a pixel-perfect re-implementation of this software. I'd show you a picture, but it would look a lot like that, whose main functionality was to have a secret knock. An attacker could wear a certain pattern, in this case a QR code registration mark, made out of lead tape on an undershirt. They could cover it up with other clothing to make it invisible to the human eye. Under X-rays, it's very, very obvious. When our software detects this mark, the operator does not see the scan as taken. They simply see an innocuous image. With this technique, an attacker who can compromise the software can carry anything they like through the scanners, including bombs and bottles of water. Okay, but that's if you have an attacker who can modify the machine in some way, who can change how it works. And so the next thing is change the attacker model to hands-off attacks. You're not allowed to touch the machine. You're simply allowed to prepare yourself and then stand in front of it. What can you do? Well, if we go back to our physics, this image I showed you earlier, the background is black because the X-rays go off into the distance. The human is white because it backscatters quite a bit. And metal contrabands, such as this firearm, are black because they absorb X-rays. Well, what if we were to simply move the contraband? We tested this. This scanned subject is carrying a 380 ACP pistol. You are welcome to play TSA agent and try and spot it in the image. I will tell you that while making these slides, I had to go back to our documentation to remember where it was. It is right there above the right knee. Firearms aren't the only contraband that might be made out of metal. We did the same sort of thing with a folding knife. You can see it's off to the side. There are lead tape arrows to help you pinpoint exactly where it is, but again, completely invisible. Note, however, that if you were to take a side scan by just turning 90 degrees to your left, the contraband becomes very obvious. But we've known for a while how to look for metal contraband. And the real reason these machines went into production, as I said before, was non-metallic threats. And the most important of those is plastic explosives. You can see here a brick of about 1 pound of plastic explosive simulant. This is a radiological simulant of C4 that's used to test X-ray detection of plastic explosives. And as I said before, the TSA implemented these and promoted them to primary after the underwear bombing in 2009 on Christmas Day. So why did TSA believe that they could use these machines to see plastic explosives? The public report that we found comes out of Sandia in 1992. This is an earlier version of the device, so it's a little bit grainy and hard to see. But the area I'd like to draw your attention to is right here on the chest. You can see two rectangular regions outlined by and suggested by darker areas, which are the shadows of the block of plastic explosive that I showed you. The plastic explosive itself is relatively the same color as the flesh underneath it, since it is an organic material made up of a lot of carbon and hydrogen. So what if you were to think adversarially? What if you were to take this block of plastic explosive and think about it real hard and realize that it's used and called plastic explosive because it's plastic? It's moldable. You can put it into any shape you'd like, including ones that may or may not leave shadows. So we went ahead and did this. One of these scanned subjects is carrying nothing and should be let through. The other scanned subject is carrying more than 200 grams of C4 simulant. In case you don't have personal experience with plastic explosives, the underwear bomber carried about 80 grams of plastic explosives, and the Lockerbie bomb was estimated to be about 300 grams. Both of these amounts should be enough to blow a hole in an aircraft. In case you haven't spotted the plastic explosive yet, it is right there on the abdomen. And placed on top of it, masquerading as the navel, is the detonator necessary to enact the explosion. So we'd say that our efficacy results strongly imply that adversaries can conceal knives, firearms, plastic explosives, and detonators. And one real interesting fact that we learned is that having access to the machine allows you to refine your attacks. The attacks I've shown you here, they didn't work the first time, but over about 5 to 10 times of improving them got to the state you see them now. And so having access to a Secure 1000, either by purchasing one or having finding an unattended one, really allows you to increase the probability that your attack will succeed. So these are the results that we have, but we think that our study can really apply to bring some lessons into developing cyber-physical security systems in the future. First is the policy implications. These devices were fielded in United States airports for 5 years, despite major flaws in how they worked. The secrecy out of the TSA means we don't know whether TSA didn't know about these flaws or simply did not act to fix them. And so we would like to say that critical security infrastructure needs independent, rigorous, and transparent testing, including cyber-physical security testing, looking at the software running these devices. Also, you need to apply adaptive adversarial thinking, as everyone in this room is familiar with. We have some lessons for developers of cyber-physical security systems. Perhaps, as researchers, you might know these already, but developers, the simple modular design of the Secure 1000 meant that even by compromising one part of it, we were unable to compromise the system as a whole. The physics that you use in your physical system actually matters. You have to understand that. You have to understand how metal looks under X-ray, how a person looks, etc. But only if the software is safe. If the software is compromised, all bets are off. The physics you use doesn't matter anymore. We also have some mitigations, because these machines, while they have been removed from airports, are still in use at jails and courthouses. So we disclosed these results and potential mitigations to DHS and Rapiscan in May of this year. Our procedural mitigations include performing side scans, which were not done in airports, and possibly layering these with metal detectors. And so to conclude, we'd like to say that the advanced imaging technology devices are deployed at nearly 160 United States airports. They likely went through the same vetting process as the Secure 1000. And we need transparency and a public review of how well those machines work. TSA is also testing new X-ray backscatter imaging machines based on the same physics. We think those machines should go through the same process as well. With that, I'd like to thank you for your attention and take any questions.
All right, so we have microphone over there, microphone over here. Please step up and ask your questions.
Adam Drew from Qualcomm. Now, the TSA is usually under a lot of political pressure to deploy things
very quickly. You can sort of see it's in response to events. And often they don't have fantastic solutions that are sort of well secured and vetted and, you know, are going to do the job under a very adversarial environment. So what would you say about, you know, trading off the need for sort of more public disclosure or review of what they're doing and the fact that they might fully know that there are holes, but at least we capture something, you know, it's sort of better than nothing.
Sure. So the question is, basically, the TSA implemented these devices. Maybe they're not perfect, but they're better than nothing. That's a good point. We can't rule out that these were the best option available to the TSA in 2009 for detecting plastic explosives, which were an issue.
So Warren Kamari, Google. Did you fly to get here? And if so, do you have additional fun going through security these days?
I did not fly to get here. My co-authors did.
Carl Kosher, University of Washington. Just a comment. So when I remember these being in use, they had a screener in a separate room who communicated back to the screening area over radio. 2 years ago, there was a paper on how the feds can't actually encrypt their radios properly. So that might be something to think about.
Thank you.
Josh Kroll, Princeton. So I can't see the guns in the images, and I think most of us can't. Do you have any reason to believe that they couldn't be discovered by some sort of image processing?
We didn't actually explore that in any depth. We feel that they are, in fact, not there.
Christoph Paul, University of Massachusetts. Would be another attack that we mask a gun or a knife with another organic material? Let's say put a stake on top of the gun or something like
that? Yes, that's a very good point. That material's in our paper. I had to cut it due to time restrictions in the talk. But we actually managed to layer a 18-centimeter knife behind several layers of plastic Teflon, and it blended quite well with the spine.
Okay, thank you.
Elvis Regis, Google. I'm curious for the gun and knife attacks, how obvious is it from an external human visual? I mean, could it be that you need to wear sufficiently baggy clothes that a human security person might be suspicious?
Right. It really depends on the size of the item you're carrying. A firearm is actually pretty difficult to carry in the correct location. Someone with more tailoring experience than I have could be better. But if you're carrying something small, it is fairly easy.
Steve Bellevin, Columbia University.
Mm-hmm.
I was intrigued by that secret knock, which you said required ROM replacement. Do you know anything about the software development processes to exclude malicious insiders on the software development side, or the process by which ROM updates are installed on these devices? If I were to go mail a set of ROMs in a suitable envelope to a user of this, what the likelihood would be if it's installed as a digital signature check or anything like that?
So the version we had is the one directly from the manufacturer. It's running the manufacturer's software. It's not the TSA software. There were no user passwords on the box. There was no encryption. There was basically nothing preventing someone at the computer from changing the software. We don't know what the recommended procedures are for updating that software.
Two questions. One, I noticed on your user interface slide that there was a save button. The TSA had said this isn't a privacy problem because you can't save the images. Can you say anything about how well protected they were when they were saved?
Okay. Again, as I said, our software was not the TSA software. Our software did, in fact, have save and load functionality. But it was both of these machines are general-purpose computers. And so if you actually managed to change the software, you could have access to the images.
The other question was, you talked about how much radiation you get by being exposed. What I wondered about, TSA agents were prohibited, and probably still are prohibited, from wearing dosimeters. And they're standing next to the machines 8 hours a day. Do you have any idea how much radiation they would get since they're not quite as close and the two machines were facing each other and there were baffles and so on?
Yeah, we didn't actually perform those experiments. It's actually a really low amount of radiation, and so detecting it accurately is very difficult.
All right, let's thank the speaker very much.